I don't think that in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, there is any story that is more written about, more discussed by the rabbis than our reading for today. Jacob's struggle with the figure in the night. On his way home to the land of his father, his grandfather, and of course, the land of his twin brother Esau. Thomas Merton, the great mystic, called Jacob's encounter at the Jabbok the prototype of all spiritual battles. But first, a little background. Most of us, I think, know well the story of Abraham's call by God, his call to leave his country, to go to a land that God would show him. His name would become great. His descendants would be as the sands of the sea or the stars of the sky, and all the world would be blessed through him. Now, Jacob is the surprising heir to that covenant promise and that blessing. He has yet grasped and usurped and hoodwinked and been hoodwinked in turn. He's a trickster. He's the second born of twins. Jacob came into the world, the midwife said, clutching the heel of his brother who was born first. And his name Jacob literally means he who grasps the heel. Figuratively, it's the deceiver, someone we might well call a heel. Really? Aptly named. Because Joseph did, in fact, live up to his name. He tricked his brother out of his birthright. When his father, Isaac, was too old to see or to hear well, he fooled him into giving him the blessing that was intended for Esau. Now, a blessing was not a blessing as we would use the word. Perhaps somebody is leaving your house, going off on a trip, and you say, God bless you. For Isaac, for someone in that day, a blessing was a word of great power. It conveyed something of the very energy and vitality of that person's soul to the one that he blesses. It was to be his final blessing to his firstborn son. So it was going to be the most powerful word that he had said in all his life. And it cannot be taken back. Now, before we dismiss this as a completely strange story and a strange practice, I think the truth is this, that words that we speak in deep love or deep hate set things in motion in the human heart that can never be reversed. Is that not true? The blessing carried that power. And when Esau knew that he had been tricked out of the blessing, Esau said, "The days of mourning for my father are very near, and then I will kill my brother Jacob." So Jacob went on the run. He went to his mother's family. And 20 years later, he is returning with two wives and 11 sons, with herds and flocks. And as our reading begins, tomorrow, he will stand face to face with Esau. Will Esau forgive him? Will he make good on his threat to kill him? A message has just come to Jacob immediately before this text, that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. Now, what would you think? Pretty ominous. So Jacob selected from all his flocks and herds, I counted them out in the text, 550 animals, sheep, goats, camels, cows, and donkeys. And he divided them all into four groups, each one of them overseen by servants. And he said, "Go ahead of me, and put some space between the herds." So then this is what he instructed the man in the lead. "When my brother Esau meets you, and he asks, 'To whom do you belong, and where are you going, and who owns all these animals in front of you?' then you are to say, They belong to your servant, Jacob. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us. So you can imagine what Jacob is starting to do. He's got this massive gift that he's giving, one after another. Thus did Jacob hope to pacify his brother. Frederick Buechner, who has written a novel on Jacob called The Son of Laughter, and a sermon on this passage, says that in all his research on Jacob, he has never, ever seen any sign that his conscience troubled him in the least. Jacob, however, does one thing that's much wiser and more mature. He sends his family and all his servants across the river Jabbok, which is just a small river that flows east into the Jordan River, and he remains behind to spend the night near the shore all by himself. And the text says that suddenly there was someone on his back. An ish, the Hebrew says, translated in our text as a man. The Midrash, which is the Jewish commentary on Scripture, calls him an angel. Some people think of him as a demon. In the end, Jacob believes it was none less than God. A commentator suggests that the narrative doesn't want us to know too much. He remains a stranger to us as he was to Jacob. And a stranger wants Jacob's life. And it was terrible for him not knowing who his adversary was. In the dark, he couldn't see, and everything is shadows. Is it Esau that somehow or other slipped up on him? Is Jacob wrestling with himself, struggling with his own demons? Is it an angel? Is it God, the God who has been hunting him down all his life? This passage is so powerful, says Herbert O'Driscoll, because it describes a universal human experience. All of us have met what he calls the 3 a.m. stranger, and we have no choice but to struggle. The stranger sees to it that we must, and as in the story, we may ask the stranger for his name, but we may already know. In that sense, his name is our own name, at least its shadow part. Our fears, our anxieties, even the terror make this stranger a formidable opponent to each of us. Now, perhaps we don't have to look very far in this story for the reason for Jacob's fear. For all his prosperity and all his possessions, he is vulnerable, and he's subject to destruction by a brother who has both the means and a good reason to do just that. In the context of a dread future that may await him on the morrow, haunted by a dread memory of what he has done and a very real sense of the distance that exists between his brother and himself, in that gulf where he is left alone, Jacob wrestles. He comes face to face with himself. He sees himself as he really is. And he comes to understand somehow that God is holding up a mirror. There is a sense in which we cannot go into our future except through our past. AA and 12-step programs are not the only ones who tell us this. All good therapy and these kind of Bible stories say as much. For Jacob, too, there's a reality that he's still literally and physically and figuratively on the run. You see, Jacob has succeeded admirably. He has wives and children and money and livestock, and he is homeless. In between places, somewhere between the promise and the fulfillment, he suffers from an emptiness or a hunger. For all he has, he lacks. Because Jacob needs reconciliation and he needs ultimate purpose, and until these things happen, hunger will remain. And I think that Jacob, in that sense, is an archetype for many of us with the same emptiness and the same hunger, though we have plenty of things and not a few successes under our belt. Because power and success and happiness, as the world knows them, are his or hers for those who will fight for them hard enough. But peace and love and joy are only from God. We've all lived through a dark night of the soul, as Jacob did. Sometimes it's brought on by our own actions, and sometimes it's simply the unfolding of life before us over which we have absolutely no control. One of the words of good news that emerges from this text is that we should not be afraid to wrestle with God. When we're moved by anger or fear, we can lash out, even if we shake our fists at God for the predicament that we find ourselves in, because we're all wrestling with something. Growing up, growing old, conniving and repenting, arrogant and broken, all at the same time. And I think that we end up feeling all alone in some God-forsaken wilderness with destiny and danger all around when the things that we thought would hold forever fall apart. A marriage, a family, a career, our lives. We never know when things will take a turn, and suddenly we will be faced with our deepest fears and our darkest doubts. And at such moments, at such times, we need to know how to struggle until the morning. We need to know how to hold on to grace. All through the night, they struggle. Until just before morning, when it looks like Jacob might actually win, the man asks to be let go. He says, "Set me free, for it's almost daybreak." And he touches the socket of Jacob's thigh, and Jacob is crippled. Now, somehow I think, even if we never heard the story before, I think that we knew it would end this way. And I think Jacob must have feared as much himself. It was as if the stranger had held back, letting Jacob almost win, letting him exert all his strength so that when he was defeated, he would know that he was truly defeated. That not all his vaunted shrewdness, not all his iron will, and not all his strength was enough to get him out of it. But still he hangs on, only now he's not hanging on in a grip of violence, it's a grip of absolute need, the grip of a drowning man. "I will not let you go unless you bless me," says he, crippled, unable to move. "What is your name?" "Jacob." "Well, you're no longer Jacob. You're no longer the deceiver. You are Israel. You are the one who wrestles with God." And refusing to give his name, he blessed Jacob. In absolute amazement that he has lived to tell it, Jacob knows that he has struggled with God, seen God face to face. That's why he calls the place Peniel, face to face with God. But he's not unscathed. He has lived, but he's lived in a new way and with a new power and with new weakness. And then he faced his brother. As Jacob asked the stranger for a blessing, so may we, you and I, if we can accept and respond to the struggle of the darkness within ourselves, then it will become a blessing in us and for us. As Jacob was forced to grow into someone greater than he had been, so also we may be changed. In this night struggle, we are indeed struggling with God, because God is also struggling with us to bring us to wholeness so that we can acknowledge the extraordinary mixture of strengths and weaknesses that each one of us really is. The Bible more than once pictures God as a potter with a hunk of clay who pounds and pushes and molds and hammers and whirls the clay on a wheel until God gets a pot that can offer someone a cup of cold water. Jacob was changed by his encounter, by his struggle with God. Absolutely exhausted as morning comes, he lifts his eyes to see Esau coming in the distance with his 400 men. And his strategy reveals his change. He goes ahead of his wives and his children, rather than sending them ahead as he intended, to buy him some time, to build sympathy with Esau. Jacob's no longer looking for an angle. Frederick Buechner, I mentioned earlier, called this event the Magnificent Defeat. That was the title of his sermon. It is a defeat because Jacob limped. It's magnificent in that he prevailed. He did not give up. If we said the crippling victory, there would be a different nuance. Jacob did gain a victory, and he limped every day of his life thereafter to show others and himself that there are no untroubled victories with this God. To say, as Jacob did, God is in this place, is a cause not only for joy and exultation, it's also a cause for awe. God is the enemy whom Jacob fought by the river, and whom, in one way or another, we all of us fight. God, the beloved enemy. Buechner says, he's our enemy because, giving us everything, he demands all of us everything. Before giving us life, he demands our lives, ourselves, our wills, and our treasure. The last sentence of our text reads, "The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip." I think this is a wonderful description, a wonderfully descriptive image of all of us. We make our different journeys, you and I, to some degree as wounded travelers. But the good news is, wounded by God, we limp toward the sunrise. Amen.